This is Audible.
Audible Originals presents The Coming Storm, written and performed by Michael Lewis.
The Coming Storm. As she walked the path that the tornado had torn through the American town, she was struck by how hard it would have been to imagine what she was now seeing. 2 days earlier, on May 22, 2011, the wind had cleaved Joplin, Missouri in two, leaving behind a lot of you-have-to-see-it-to-believe-it stuff. A rubber hose run entirely through a tree trunk, a chair sideways, all four legs piercing a wall, a giant Walmart tractor trailer thrown 200 yards on top of what had been the Pepsi building, a full-size SUV folded in half around a tree. Only the metal had been flayed from the car, and the tree was no longer a tree but a tree trunk, as all the trees had snapped and blown away. "I felt like some giant had taken an egg beater and run it through a town," said Kathy Sullivan. "It was toothpicks." Then she realized that the egg beater metaphor was not exactly right, as the edges of the destruction were eerily undisturbed. What the tornado had narrowly missed was as perfectly preserved as what it had hit was perfectly eliminated. "It was like when you run your finger through the icing on top of a cake," she said, "a clean line of total destruction." Doctors in the local emergency rooms were seeing trauma they'd never seen. Body parts strewn on the ground outside the hospital. A small child, back stripped of flesh right down to the bone. They could count his vertebra. People impaled by street signs. People with wounds that looked as if they were caused by automatic rifles, except that the objects deep inside them were not bullets. Seriously injured people had driven themselves to the hospital with dead loved ones in their cars and apologized to the hospital staff. They didn't know what else to do with the bodies. Tornado outbreaks in the middle of the United States that spring had killed more than 500 people. In Joplin alone, 158 people had died and thousands had been injured, many critically. That was more than had been killed by a single tornado since the United States government had taken on the job of warning people about them. In and of itself, this was shocking, but to Kathy Sullivan, it was especially so. These people had been informed. The warnings from the National Weather Service, which would soon be reporting to her, had been even better this time than they usually were. The initial tornado watch had come 4 hours before the event, but then a tornado watch is different from a tornado warning. The average National Weather Service tornado warning comes 13 minutes before a tornado strikes. Joplin's sirens had sounded the warning 17 minutes in advance, but the citizens of Joplin had ignored them. The majority of the surveyed Joplin residents did not immediately go to shelter upon hearing the initial warning, as the report Sullivan would soon oversee noted. One day someone will write a history of the strange relationship between the United States government and its citizens. It would need at least a chapter on the government's attempts to save the citizens from the things that might kill them. The first successful tornado prediction was made on an Air Force base in Norman, Oklahoma, in 1948. The men who'd made it had been lucky. They wouldn't be able to do it again. Knowing this, the government had taken the view that the people were better off not being warned. In fact, the Weather Bureau, as it was then called, was banned from using the word tornado. It just frightened people, they believed. But word got out. The government meteorologists had this mysterious new skill, and the people demanded to hear what they had to say, even if what they had to say was of little value. Since then, the government meteorologists had gotten better at their jobs. The billions of dollars they'd spent on satellites, radar, computing power, and better forecast models had led to, among other things, truly useful tornado warnings. And yet the citizens didn't seem to realize that the government's weather information was more and more reliable, or even that it was their government giving it to them. It no longer shocked Kathy Sullivan to hear otherwise educated citizens say that they got their weather from the Weather Channel or some app on their phone. A United States congressman had asked her why the taxpayer needed to fund the National Weather Service when he could get his weather from AccuWeather. Where on earth did he think AccuWeather, or the apps, or the Weather Channel got their weather? Where was AccuWeather when 200-and-something mile-an-hour winds were churning through an American town, killing people? Clearly the citizens didn't understand their government, but that had been true for some time. Now Kathy saw that the government didn't really understand its citizens either. Why hadn't they saved themselves? If anyone should know the answer to that question, it was her, and she had no clue. In some curious way, the United States government had a better handle on the weather than on its own people. It had spent billions of dollars to collect data about the weather, and none about how people responded to it. She could not help but admire these people. Walking through the ruins, she saw all over again what she'd seen so many times. How much better Americans were at responding to a disaster than at preventing it. Everybody who could was pitching in to help. The border of the devastated area looked like a tailgater at a college football game. The people who had been spared were cooking food for the people who had not. "No one asked questions," said Kathy. "No one asked if your home had been destroyed. If you walked up and said you were hungry, you got food." No one could say she hadn't done her job. She was not by nature or upbringing a political person, but her ambition had led her to become one. She'd made all the little compromises, done all the little deals with others and with herself, required to survive in the upper reaches of the American government. She was now second in command, and soon to be first, at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. NOAA oversaw the National Weather Service, among other things. The National Weather Service had seen the tornado and issued a warning. Her people had given these people what they needed to survive. And yet on May 22, 2011, more Americans had been killed by a single tornado than on any day in the past 64 years. She might have said nothing, just thrown up her hands in the privacy of her office and told herself that it wasn't her job to save people from their own stupidity. Instead, she asked herself, what don't we understand about our own citizens? She flew back to Washington and gathered the relevant parties, all of whom might have claimed credit for a job well done, and asked them, is anybody here happy with the outcome? To their credit and hers, no one was. Before Kathy Sullivan had been given her first paying job by the United States government, it had put her through a battery of tests. Some were physical, some were psychological, and others, well, she didn't know quite what they were. At no point during them had she figured out what the people from the National Aeronautics and Space Administration were looking for. She endured two virtually identical interviews, one with a good NASA cop, the other with a bad NASA cop. The bad cop made you feel uncomfortable, she said. The room was ill-lit. He sat behind the desk, and you sat in an exposed chair. You weren't facing each other. He was mumbling and not friendly. Then they did it all over again with the warm, sunny guy who was your best friend. Only much later did she learn that they wanted to see if she answered the same question the same way, whether she was at ease or not. I didn't have anything to compare it to, she said. You might try to manipulate the system, but you need to know the system, and I didn't. Later she decided that they weren't even really trying to figure out who she was. All they had wanted was the answer to a question. Will she be that same person that she appears to be now when she's traveling at 17,500 miles per hour, 140 miles above the Earth, and something goes bang? This was her first job interview, and she was applying to be an astronaut. It was 1977, but the work was still risky. Every flight was still proving that you can get up there and come back alive, she said. It's like riding bombs. Still, 8,078 other Americans had applied for the job. 5,608 of these had satisfied the basic job requirements. Of these, NASA invited 208 people to the Johnson Space Center outside Houston for a week of interviews. They interviewed us in groups of 20, Kathy said. I got there and saw this cluster of other people. It was all guys. That was okay. I'd been the only woman in a field camp and the only woman on a ship. The difference was this wasn't just guys, but a club. Her sense was, a lot of these guys know each other. They're fighter pilots or whatever, she said. I'm 25, I'm a grad student, I'm broke. They seemed to be settled in and knew what they're doing, and I didn't. I thought, well, Catherine, enjoy the week. The main event was a 90-minute interview at a long table filled with strangers. One was the famously inscrutable head of the astronaut program, George Abbey. At the start, he leaned back in his chair, eyes half closed, and did not so much ask as mutter, "Tell us about yourself. Start with high school." That was it. Nothing more. It was deliberately underspecified, Kathy said. Telling people about herself was not her strong suit. I've never been a self-revealing person, she said. She went ahead and told them about herself anyway. How by the age of 13 she'd learned from her father, an aerospace engineer, to fly a plane. How she was a girl growing up in the 50s and 60s, and being a pilot did not seem to her a career option, so she assumed that her ticket to adventure was her gift for languages. Before she graduated from high school, without setting foot in France or Germany, she'd become fluent in both French and German. She'd planned to learn a bunch more languages. My simple theory was, learn lots of languages and use them to see the world, she recalled in an oral history for NASA's Johnson Space Center. She entered UC Santa Cruz in 1969 as a language major. But there was a science requirement, and to fulfill it, she took two classes in ocean science. There she learned that human beings were now descending 14,000 feet in tiny submarines and mapping the ocean floor. It was endlessly fascinating, she said, this mix of things I'd always seen on the pages of National Geographic. The travel she'd imagined until then had been horizontal, east or west, north or south. She now began to imagine it as vertical, too, up and down. She wanted to study the plates beneath the bottom of the sea. She was accepted into graduate geology programs everywhere she applied, including Princeton, with full research fellowships. She accepted the free ride at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia, because what interested her was the mountain range at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, known as the Mid-Ocean Ridge, and for several reasons Nova Scotia seemed to her the best place to study it. From just about the moment she arrived, she started looking for access to a submarine that could take her down so that she might inspect the Mid-Ocean Ridge in person. I'm pursuing an academic career and asking, how do I get into one of those submarines? I want to go see the stuff for myself. It was her brother who had first told her about NASA's new need for astronauts. He'd seen an ad in the newspaper announcing the space agency was opening its rocket ships to all Americans between the age of 25 and 40, under 6 feet tall, weighing less than 180 pounds, and in possession of just about any sort of college science degree. He'd already applied and thought she should too. Women were specifically encouraged for the first time. Minorities, too. All that was required were some character traits, a willingness to accept hazards comparable to those encountered in modern research airplane flights, a capacity to tolerate rigorous and severe environmental conditions, and an ability to react adequately under conditions of stress or emergency. Up to that moment, NASA had been looking mainly for test pilots who could at least feign indifference to their mortality. Now they were looking for scientists. Or at least for scientifically minded people, but with a twist. They needed the temperaments of fighter jocks. Kathy hadn't taken her brother seriously. You really think they're going to hire an oceanographer? A girl? A few weeks later, she ran across the call for astronauts again, this time in a science journal. They really did seem to want women scientists, and she sensed that she might be the sort of woman they were looking for. I never brought normal girl books home from the library, she recalled. I was fascinated by maps and the stories they told. She was handy, too, and quick to figure out how things worked. I kind of always flunked the dolls test, she told an interviewer for the Johnson Space Center's oral history project. I never found the dolls interesting. The doll house stuff I found interesting, but from an architectural point of view, building them. And I'd want to lay them out differently. I didn't just want to move the furniture around, and I sure didn't want to just sit there and imagine conversations between dolls that never happened. Let me go build another house. That was more interesting. The head of NASA's astronaut program had asked her to tell them about herself, but she sensed that they were after something else, too. They listened without saying a word until she got to the point in her story where she was on a ship in the ocean, in a storm, conducting research. It was the aspect of research oceanography she loved best. Figuring out how to adapt everything to what happens while you're at sea and still come back with the data that you needed and the accuracy that you needed, she said. That's where I was at my best. George Abbey interrupted her just as she was describing how, in the middle of a storm, in the middle of the night, a critical piece of research equipment had busted. She'd had to haul it into the boat in the darkness and inspect each segment. The oceanographer in charge of the expedition had watched her labor for the first few hours, but finally turned grumpy. "Just fix the damn thing," he'd said and gone to bed. "So what did you do?" Abby had asked her. "What do you mean, what did I do?" she said. "We fixed it." "And then you went to bed?" he asked. I felt like saying, "No, you idiot. I did not go to bed." Instead, she explained she'd stayed up for 2 more hours to make sure her fix held in the storm. Later, her interviewers had her take a Myers-Briggs-type personality test. Like virtually all the astronauts, but unlike roughly 85% of the American population, she profiled as a mission-driven person. The mission-driven type was overrepresented in the astronaut population, she said in her oral history, whereas more dreamer or salesman-type folks were very underrepresented. From the original 8,000 or so applicants, NASA selected 35 to become astronauts. 6 were women, all scientists. A lot of the men were indeed former fighter pilots. They tended to see themselves as the main event and looked upon the women scientists assigned to accompany them as a sideshow. Kathy wasn't shy about expressing her thoughts on this subject. "You know you're just my taxi driver," she told one of the pilots. "My job is the interesting part of this mission." He didn't like it, but the space program was changing. "By the time I got to it," she said, "it had gone from just proving you could get up there and come home alive to, what are we doing here?" What they were doing in space was what she sensed she'd been put on Earth to do, explore, gather data, and make sense of it. The science was 3 big things, she said. Bullet point 1, using space as a platform to look back at Earth and out into the cosmos, getting a different point of view. There's a kind of understanding of this planet that space alone makes possible. Bullet point 2, what do we need to know that we don't know about living in space? Bullet point 3, how does the human body respond to being sprung from the force of gravity? How do fluids flow? How does the body behave? What had grabbed her attention from the start was the Earth science, the snapshot that might be taken of Earth from above, of the current conditions on Earth that were going to be crucial to man's understanding of his environment. "I was all about bullet point 1, said Kathy. She couldn't just skip the other bullet points, however. She might see her job as gathering data about the planet, but a lot of other people saw their jobs as gathering data about her. They now had another kind of human body to study, though it was reluctant. "I was moderately disinterested in being a lab rat," she said. It didn't help that the engineers at the heart of the space program had some strange notions about women. For instance, that they were more vulnerable to rapid decreases in pressure. The Air Force worked with this aerospace medical unit, she said, that concluded that the women were more likely to experience the bends when the pressure went from high to low. They think they've detected a higher instance of damage to the central nervous system. They tell them, "I'm going to die." She thought, "You guys don't have enough data, and the data you have, you've handled badly." She pointed out that female deep-sea divers didn't experience any special problems at lower depths. It was an open question as to which was more mysterious to a male NASA engineer, outer space or the American female. They appeared to have better data on outer space. They prepared makeup kits for the shuttle, for instance, even though Kathy and a couple of the other women astronauts didn't wear makeup. They set out to design inflammable one-size-fits-all bras and panties until the women astronauts explained that the one-size-fits-all approach used for men's underwear wasn't going to work with the women's underwear. In the end, they won the right to buy their own inflammable underwear. And how would a woman urinate in space? The engineers worried about that one for a while. The male astronauts had been fitted with condom catheters, but these were always threatening to leak or even burst, and obviously wouldn't work for women. To everyone's relief, some clever NASA engineer created an extra absorbent polymer and worked it into a diaper that could be worn by all. In the bargain, he'd invented the baby diaper of the future. And of course, the male engineers were seriously worried about what might ensue if a woman got her period in space. "The idea that women might menstruate in orbit drove the whole place up a wall," said Kathy. The male world's response was, "Oh, that's okay. We'll just suppress their periods." We all looked at each other and said, "You and what other army, buddy?" The engineers finally agreed to pack tampons in the supply kits. The first time Kathy opened her kit, She saw that each tampon had been removed from its paper wrapper and sealed in a plastic fireproof case, heat-sealed tampons. Each plastic case was connected to another. She pulled on the top one, and out pops this great long chain of little plastic red cases, like a string of firecrackers. Hundreds of tampons, for one woman to survive for a few days in space. It was like a bad stage act, she said. There just seemed this endless unfurling of Lord only knows how many tampons. The engineers eventually sat down with the female astronauts to discuss the matter. Would 100 be the right number? They asked. Kathy Sullivan worried that NASA might use the differences between their bodies as an excuse to write different rules for males and females. The male astronauts, on the other hand, adapted pretty quickly to the presence of women. The guy she'd been assigned to walk with in space was named Dave Listma. They had a moment together that captured the spirit of their interaction. They were training for the first time in their spacesuits. The first step was to remove their clothes and put on the first layer of the 225-pound suit, the so-called liquid cooling ventilation garment. The test chamber was full of male engineers. I had this fleeting sense that everyone had just realized that we're about to go boldly where no man has gone before. There's a woman in this mix, said Kathy in her NASA oral history. So I looked over to Dave and said, Dave, let me tell you my philosophy about modesty in circumstances like this. He shifts a bit and says, okay. I said, I have none. He said, fine. We start peeling off our clothes. Kathy could not have been less interested in the gender drama. She just wanted to go to space and see it for myself, not in a magazine picture. She wanted to get on with the mission, which was why she'd never complained about her spacesuit. It was a small, medium, large kind of thing, not a custom fit kind of thing, she said. My knee was never in the knee of the suit. The suits were stiff and took real muscle to move. Whenever I had to bend my legs, I had to overcome this extra leverage. By the time she realized that her suit was never going to fit, NASA had asked her to wear it. I was not going to turn this into, see, we told you she'd be all this extra trouble. I decided we're just sucking this up. But really, her spacesuit should have come with a warning label. A few months earlier, in a test chamber, a NASA engineer had flipped the switch that enabled its emergency oxygen tank, and the suit had exploded into a giant fireball. If you're doing some weird test that's unlike anything that you normally do, it would still get your full attention, Kathy said later. But this was like saying that when you step on the gas of your car, it's going to explode. Highly discomforting. It was now October 11th, 1984. The Challenger was in orbit, with her inside it, waiting to walk in space. The air was gone from the airlock. When they simulated this moment back on Earth, they put a baking pan with water on the floor, just to illustrate what might happen to your body's fluids if something went wrong with your suit. As the pressure dropped, the water would bubble violently, as if it were boiling. But then a couple of seconds later, it would flash freeze into ice crystals. Poof. Don't open your visor, they'd say. On a mission this complicated, it was actually impossible to imagine everything that might kill you. The O-rings of the very spacecraft in whose airlock she now floated would soon become the most famous illustration of the point. Just 15 months later, the failure of NASA to heed engineers' warnings about how brittle the rings that sealed the solid rocket boosters could become in the cold, would lead the boosters to leak and the Challenger to blow up, killing all the astronauts on board. Later, when someone asked Kathy Sullivan why it never seemed to occur to her to be afraid, she had an answer. In college, she'd gone bushwhacking with a boyfriend around the Grand Canyon. They'd hacked a trail in a bad place, and they now had to jump down onto a narrow ledge or go tumbling down a steep slope. The slightest misstep, and she'd fall to her death. I mean, my knees are wobbling and shaking, and I remember thinking, not now. Then she was fine. Right then, she discovered an emotional talent. She had the ability to decide not to be afraid. All the astronauts had it, she'd noticed. If you're scared, I don't want you to be there, she said. Be here, now, here, now. This is the game. Be scared before. Be scared later. Not during. Inside her spacesuit, with the pressure gone from the Challenger's airlock, she felt no change at all, and that struck her here as strange as it had on Earth. I always thought, isn't this room supposed to look different when there's no air in it? But there's no difference. She moved along a handrail to open the hatch. She poked her head out into space. Then she reached out and tethered herself to the hook on the outside of the capsule before untethering herself from the hook inside the airlock. Mountaineering 101, she called it. With her body traveling at 17,500 miles per hour, she set out, hand over hand, to demonstrate that it was indeed possible to refuel a satellite in orbit. And with that, she became the first American woman to walk in space. That first step would shadow her for the rest of her life. President Reagan would invite her to a dinner at the White House and sit her beside him. Corporations would offer her high-paying jobs. Civic organizations across the country would offer her awards and ask her to come and tell her story. Seemingly all of Long Island would soon be in touch, because at some point in space, she'd look down, how could she not, and shouted, "Hey, there's Long Island!" She had a choice of how to play her experience. "You can dine out on this stuff forever," she said. But that was feeling shallow to me. I wanted to make the experience matter. The same internal process that had led her to decline the role of girl made it possible for her to pass on the role of lady astronaut. She flew twice more into space, orbited the Earth a few hundred more times, and then, in the early 1990s, went looking for something else to do. She now had a measure of celebrity and needed to make a decision about how to best use it. She wanted another mission that felt as important as the one she'd just completed. She wanted to do Earth science, and she wanted the stakes of the science to be high. That wasn't surprising. What was surprising was where she finally found her mission: the United States Department of Commerce. Around the same time, DJ Patil had also wandered into the Department of Commerce, though in truth he didn't know it. Physically, he was sitting at a desk on the campus of the University of Maryland, pursuing his PhD in mathematics. He'd found a security hole in the U.S. government's computers, and he reached through it to grab what he needed. What he needed was a very specific pile of data. That it, like much of the rest of the government's data, resided in the Department of Commerce, he hadn't bothered to figure out. DJ had come to Maryland from California to study with James York, a professor who'd recently coined the term chaos theory. The idea was simple. Some small, barely noticed event can cascade into huge consequences down the road. The day your parents met, for instance. What if that hadn't happened? A lot of the drama in his life, DJ traced back to a small, little-noticed event in his early childhood, a tendency to reverse the order of numbers. When you see 16 as 61, you have problems in school. Struggling with his assigned tasks, he diverted himself with unassigned ones. Watching spy movies, he became intrigued with picking locks. He'd pick his way into other kids' lockers, move the stuff around inside, then lock them back up, just to freak them out. Then he learned how to pick people's pockets for fun. He'd take the car keys off some unsuspecting grown-up, move his car, then return the keys to the guy's jacket pocket. In the eighth grade, he hacked the English teacher's computer and changed the grades, and never got caught. In ninth grade, his prank gone wrong set an entire hillside in a well-to-do Silicon Valley neighborhood on fire. He ended up listening to a cop read him his rights. The landowner agreed not to prosecute if DJ agreed to spend the next few months in hard labor restoring the hillside. While he was doing that, he got himself suspended from his English class for exploding a stink bomb, and then a few months after that, from math class for, well, at this point, it hardly mattered. By the time he graduated from high school, after a merciful school administrator changed an F on his transcript to a C, he wasn't the only one who might look at DJ and see J.D. At De Anza Community College, he stumbled into a calculus class and liked it. More than liked it. He realized he had a gift for it. The calculus class was another small life event that wound up having big effects. By the time he arrived in Maryland to pursue his Ph.D., he was still interested in math, but not so much as what might be done with it to study a lot of otherwise inexplicable things that happened in life and nature. "I was always in love with the patterns in nature," he said, "and what I needed were the tools to understand them. And for me, math was the most sensible." All sorts of natural phenomena might be modeled and understood with the new chaos theory. The collapse of the sardine population off the California coast, for example, or the bizarre long landslides that occurred in the Mojave Desert, where the rocks ended up inexplicably far from where they'd started, given the slope of the journey. These long-run landslides are crazy. The question is, how did the rocks end up so far away? He asked. In theory, the new math might explain it. In practice, there wasn't enough data on the movement of the rocks, or the sardine holocaust, for him or anyone else effectively to study them. The same went for traffic jams, the boom-bust cycles in the wolf and deer populations in the American West, and countless other big events triggered by surprisingly small ones. Then he happened upon the weather. He'd always been interested in it, but never thought of it as something he might study, until he discovered that the U.S. government was sitting on a huge trove of weather data. It resided inside something called the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which was in turn inside of the Department of Commerce. But he didn't have any idea of that yet. He was just roaming around servers inside the U.S. government, the sole supplier of the data he needed if he was going to get his Ph.D. The only place I could get the data was the weather, he said. Since the end of the Second World War, weather data collection has become maybe the greatest illustration of the possibilities of global collaboration and public spiritedness. Every day, thousands of amateur weather observers report data to their governments, as do a lot of commercial planes in the sky and ships at sea. Every day, twice a day, almost 900 weather balloons are released from 900 different spots on the globe, 92 of them by the U.S. government. A half dozen countries, including the United States, deploy thousands of buoys to collect weather from the ocean surface. Then there's the data collected by billion-dollar satellites and fancy radar stations. In the United States alone, the National Weather Service maintains 159 high-resolution Doppler radar sites. The United States shares its weather data with foreign countries, just as foreign countries share their weather data with the United States. But back in 1996, when DJ was hacking the Department of Commerce computer servers, weather data was not generally available to even the most enterprising hacker. It wasn't open to the public, said DJ, but it turned out there was a hole. What came through that hole was such a vast trove of information that it overwhelmed the capacity of the computers inside the University of Maryland's math department. So DJ hunted for other computers at the university he might use. You can get the historical data and play with it, he said. It was the original idea of the internet. I was that guy. I didn't have a supercomputer, so I just had to steal that too. He'd start work at 8 every night when no one else was using the computers and go until 7 the next morning. He cobbled together enough storage to hold his borrowed treasure. That was my academic claim to fame, he said, that I downloaded the Weather Service's data. In the data, a couple of things became apparent. First, the weather forecasts were improving much more dramatically than he'd imagined. No one else was paying attention to this, but for the first time in history, the weatherman was becoming useful. Before the Second World War, meteorology had been a bit like medicine in the 19th century. The demand for expertise was so relentless that the supply had no choice but to make a fraudulent appearance. Right through the 1970s, the weather forecaster would look at the available weather information and, relying heavily on his judgment and personal experience, offer a prediction. His vision typically extended no more than 36 hours into the future, and even then it was blurry. Snow will fall somewhere over these three states. For a very long time, the weather had been only theoretically predictable. That is, people had some pretty good ideas about how it might be predicted, without being able to do so. Around the time DJ began downloading it, the weather data had led to practical progress that shocked even the theoreticians. On March 12, 1993, what became known as the Storm of the Century hit the eastern United States. Its force was incredible. Waves in the Gulf of Mexico sank a 200-foot ship. Roofs across southern states collapsed under the weight of snow. Tornadoes killed dozens of people. Travel ceased along the entire eastern seaboard. But the biggest difference between this storm and those that had come before it was that it had been predicted by a model. Following a segment on the CBS Evening News, about the siege on the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas. Louis Uccellini, a meteorologist from the National Weather Service, had warned of the coming massive threat. The TV hosts had treated the nation's chief weatherman with amusement. They ended the story by saying, "The weatherman is usually wrong." But this time he wasn't. The National Weather Service had relied on its forecasting model with no human laying hands on the results, and it had predicted the location and severity of the storm 5 days before it hit. "It was unheard of," said Uccellini later. "When I started in the 1970s, the idea of predicting extreme events was almost forbidden. How can you see a storm before the storm can be seen? This time, states declared an emergency before the first flake of snow. It was just amazing for us to watch. We sat there wrapping our heads around what we'd done." Uccellini later described the advances in weather prediction from about the end of World War II as one of the great intellectual accomplishments of the 20th century. The accomplishment received surprisingly little attention, perhaps because it was, at least at first, difficult to see. It wasn't as if one day the weather could not be predicted and the next it could be predicted with perfect accuracy. What was happening was a shift in the odds that the weather forecast was right. It was the difference between watching an ordinary blackjack player and a blackjack player who was counting the cards. Over time, the skill is the difference between losing and beating the house. But at any given moment, it's impossible to detect. DJ could see that this progress was a very big deal, a world historic event. Here you could see chaos theory dramatized, but in reverse. You could rewind history and consider how things might have come out differently if our ability to predict the weather had been even a tiny bit better or worse. "The failed hostage rescue in Iran was caused by a sandstorm we didn't see coming," said DJ. "The Kosovo offensive was so effective because we knew we'd have cloud cover." You could pick almost any extreme weather event and imagine a different outcome for it if only people had known it was coming. The hurricane that struck Galveston, Texas back in 1900, before anyone thought to name such storms, had struck without warning and killed so many people that no one knew exactly how many it killed, maybe 6,000 or maybe 12,000. What their grandchildren would know about the weather might have saved them all. Here was yet another illustration of chaos in life. Even slight changes in our ability to predict the weather might have fantastic ripple effects. The weather itself was chaotic. Some slight change in the conditions somewhere on the planet could lead to huge effects elsewhere. The academic meteorologists around DJ knew this. The question was, what to do about it? The meteorology department at the University of Maryland, as it happened, had led a new movement in forecasting and spurred the National Weather Service to change its approach to its own models. Before December 1992, the Weather Service meteorologists had simply plugged the data they had into their forecasting models: wind speeds, barometric pressure, ocean temperatures, and so on. But most of the planet's weather went unobserved. There was no hard data. As a result, many of the model's inputs were just estimates. You didn't actually know the wind speed or barometric pressure or humidity or anything else at every spot on the planet. An idea pursued at Maryland and a couple of other places was to run the weather model over and over with different initial weather conditions. Alter the conditions slightly in reasonable ways. Vary the wind speed or barometric pressure at 10,000 feet or the ocean temperature or whatever seemed reasonable to vary. How you did this was its own art. Do it 20 times, and you wind up with 20 different forecasts. A range of forecasts generated a truer prediction of the weather than a single forecast, because it captured the uncertainty of each one. Instead of saying, "Here's where the hurricane's going," or "We have no idea where the hurricane's going," you could say, "We don't know for sure where the hurricane might go, but we have a cone of probability you can use to make your decisions." Ensemble forecasting, the new technique was called. It implied that every weather forecast, and not just hurricanes, should include a cone of uncertainty. Why they don't is a great question. "There's a storm coming on Saturday" means one thing if all the forecasts in the ensemble say the storm is coming. It means another if some of the forecasts say there is no chance of rain on Saturday, and others say that a storm is all but certain. Really, the weather predictions should reflect this uncertainty. Why is the newspaper always giving us a 5-day forecast? Asked DJ. It should be a 2-day forecast sometimes, and it should be a 14-day forecast other times. By the time DJ discovered the security hole in the government's database, the National Weather Service had taken to ensemble forecasting and was generating a dozen or more forecasts for each day. On some days, the forecast would be largely in agreement. Slight changes in the estimates of current weather conditions did not lead to big changes in the future weather. At other times, they varied, radically. That is, sometimes the weather was highly chaotic and sometimes not. DJ quickly saw that the instability was not in any way linked to severity. A Cat 5 hurricane might keep on being a Cat 5 hurricane without a whole lot of doubt. Then, other times, it wouldn't. Why, in the case of one storm, are the forecasts all the same? In the case of another, they're all different, he asked. Why was the weather sometimes highly predictable and other times less so? Or as DJ put it, why does a butterfly flapping its wings in Brazil cause or not cause a tornado in Oklahoma? With the government's data, he was able to contribute a new idea, that the predictability of the weather might itself be quantified. We all know the weather's chaotic, he said. The question is, how chaotic? You should be able to assess when a forecast is likely to go seriously bad versus when the weather is stable. In the end, DJ's thesis created a new statistic, how predictable the weather was at any given moment. When he defended his thesis in the summer of 2001, he was surprised by what the U.S. government's data had enabled him to do. As a grad student, you're just like, I hope I have something that doesn't suck. You don't expect your stuff actually to work. He wasn't a meteorologist. Yet he'd found a new way to describe the weather. He'd also found, in himself, a more general interest in data. What else might it be used to discover? The relevance of that ambition became a bit clearer after the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. There was a sense that this was, among other things, a failure of data analysis, he said. If we'd known how to distinguish signal from noise, we'd have seen it and prevented it. Hey, why are all these guys suddenly taking flight lessons? The assassins' use of credit cards alone, properly analyzed, would have revealed they were up to no good. The image of a good network is messy, said DJ. It's really hard to fake messiness. It's hard to fake being an American with a credit card. The big question now in DJ's world was, how, using data, do you identify threats to U.S. interests? By this time, a young postdoc at Maryland, he attended a talk by a guy who ran something called the Defense Threat Reduction Agency. The agency, inside the U.S. Department of Defense, was charged with defending the country against weapons of mass destruction. It was trying to understand terrorist networks, so it might disrupt them. I hear the talk and I was like, wait a second, DJ recalled. The idea that if you push a network in a certain way, it might collapse. Is the network stable or unstable? It's a lot like the question I was asking about weather forecasts. A terrorist network, like a thunderstorm, might be chaotic. Terrorist networks, along with a lot of other security matters, might be better understood with chaos theory. If you pull out a node in a terrorist cell, does it collapse? He asked. Or the opposite. How do we design our electricity grid so that if you take out a node, it does not collapse? Thinking he would make use of his data skills, he went to work at the Department of Defense, where he expected to look for patterns in terrorist networks. But instead of sticking him at a computer, his new employer shipped him off to a couple of former Soviet republics to track and understand the stockpiles of biological and chemical weapons left behind by the Russians. They tell me, we need you to go to Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, and I'm like, I'm a mathematician. That was the first question I asked. Why me? They said, hey, you're a doctor. And I said, I'm not that kind of doctor. And they said, close enough, you'll figure it out. After that, they sent him to Iraq to help rebuild the school system. All of the work was interesting and a lot of it was useful, but it didn't have much to do with his deep ambition. People still didn't really appreciate how you can use data to transform, he said. To his surprise, this was true even of people back home, where DJ had grown up, in Silicon Valley, to which he soon returned. Even there, he couldn't get a job doing what he wanted to do with data. I was just trying to figure out where I could be helpful, he said. Google passed on me, Yahoo passed on me. His mom knew someone at eBay, and so he finally was hired the undignified way. At eBay, he tried and failed to persuade his superiors to let him use the data on hand to find new ways to detect fraud. At length, he moved to a new, slow-growing company called LinkedIn, where job seekers posted their CVs and attempted to create their own little networks. His new bosses asked him to be head of analytics. There, for the first time, he found an audience receptive to his pitch. "The same tools you use to identify where bad guys are, you can do with job skills," he said. "You can show people where skills cluster, where they might belong in the economy. If you're trained in the Army in ordnance disposal, maybe you'd be good at mining." In fact, the analytics he'd created at LinkedIn had done exactly that, prodded an Army bomb expert to find work setting explosives in mines, along with much more. In the space of a few years, the interest in data analysis went from a curiosity to a fad. The fetish for data overran everything from political campaigns to the management of baseball teams. Inside LinkedIn, DJ presided over an explosion of job titles that describe similar tasks. Analyst, business analyst, data analyst, research sci. The people in human resources complained to him that the company had too many data-related job titles. The company was about to go public, and they wanted to clean up the organization chart. To that end, DJ sat down with his counterpart at Facebook, who was dealing with the same problem. What could they call all of these data people? "Data scientist," his Facebook friend suggested. "We weren't trying to create a new field or anything, just trying to get HR off our backs," said DJ. He replaced the job titles for some openings with "data scientist." To his surprise, the number and caliber of the applicants for the job skyrocketed. Data scientists were what people wanted to be. In the fall of 2014, someone from the White House called him. Obama was coming to San Francisco and wanted to meet with him. He'd seen the power of data on his campaign, said DJ, and he knew that there was a new opportunity to use it to transform the country. When the White House asked him if he wanted to bring his wife to the meeting, DJ figured that Obama was looking for more than a conversation. Inside of 8 years, he'd gone from a guy who couldn't get a job in Silicon Valley to a guy the President of the United States wanted to make a job offer he couldn't refuse. When Obama did ask DJ to move to Washington, it was DJ's wife who responded. "How do we know if any of this will be of any use?" she asked, intelligently. "If your husband's as good as everyone says he is, he'll figure it out," said Obama, which of course made it even harder for DJ to refuse. DJ went to Washington. His assignment was to figure out how to make better use of the vast troves of data created by the U.S. government. His title, the Chief Data Scientist of the United States. He'd be the first person to hold the job. He made his first call at the Department of Commerce to meet with Penny Pritzker, the Commerce Secretary, and with Kathy Sullivan, the head of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. They were pleased to see him, but also a bit taken aback that he'd come. "They seemed a little surprised I was there," said DJ. "I said, I'm the data guy, and you're the data agency. This is where a huge amount of the data is." And they're like, "Yes, but how did you know?" Nobody understood what it did. But then, like so many United States government agencies, the Department of Commerce was seriously misnamed. It had almost nothing to do with commerce directly, and was actually forbidden by law from engaging in business. But it ran the United States Census, the only real picture of who Americans were as a nation. It collected and made sense of all the country's economic statistics, without which the nation would have very little idea of how it was doing. Through the Patent and Trademark Office, it tracked all the country's inventions. It contained an obscure but wildly influential agency called the National Institute of Standards and Technology, stuffed with Nobel laureates, which did everything from setting the standards for construction materials to determining the definition of a second and of an inch. It's more complicated than you think. But of the roughly $9 billion spent each year by the Commerce Department, $5 billion went to NOAA, and the bulk of that money was spent, one way or another, on figuring out the weather. Each and every day, NOAA collects twice as much data as is contained in the entire book collection of the Library of Congress. Commerce is one of the most misunderstood jobs in the cabinet because everyone thinks it works with business, says Rebecca Blank, a former acting Secretary of Commerce in the Obama administration and now Chancellor of the University of Wisconsin. It produces public goods that are of value to business, but that's different. Every secretary who comes in thinks commerce does trade. But trade is maybe 10% of what commerce does, if that. The Department of Commerce should really be called the Department of Information, or maybe the Department of Data. Get to know the U.S. government had not been high on Donald Trump's to-do list, even after he learned that he'd be running it. On the Monday after the presidential election, the same thing that had happened across the rest of the U.S. government happened inside the Department of Commerce. Nothing. Dozens of civil servants sat all day waiting to deliver briefings that would, in the end, never be heard. They'd expected Trump's campaign organization to send in so-called landing teams to learn about what was being done there and why. The problems that had been Obama's problems for the past 8 years were about to become Trump's problems. But his people didn't seem to want to know about them. They just didn't bring any bodies in at all, says a senior commerce official. There was just very little attention paid to any of the pieces. The census? They just didn't seem interested in knowing any of that. It all seemed to be about trade, or the size of the commerce workforce. Right up until early January, no one turned up at NOAA to figure out who should run the place and how they would run it. But at the end of November, Trump nominated Wilbur Ross, a 79-year-old Wall Street billionaire, to be the next Secretary of Commerce. A few weeks later, Ross came in for a single meeting with Penny Pritzker. "He came by himself," recalled one of the people who greeted him. "I was shocked. Just this very old guy, all by himself. And it was pretty clear he had no idea what he was getting into, and he had no help." He also soon had a problem, $2 billion or so missing dollars. A Forbes reporter named Dan Alexander, studying the financial disclosure forms Ross had been required to file with the Office of Government Ethics, had been struck by the discrepancy between how much money Ross said he had and how much he'd told Forbes reporters that he had over many years. How had $3.7 billion suddenly become $700 million? $3.7 billion is what Ross had told Forbes he was worth. He'd sent Forbes a list of his assets every year for the past 13 years, so that he'd qualify for the magazine's annual list of the 400 richest Americans. He'd always failed to answer Forbes' follow-up questions, and so the people at Forbes who compiled the list reduced the number to $2.9 billion, just to be conservative about it. Alexander was now one of the Forbes staffers who compiled the magazine's rich list, and he had access to the Forbes files. "I thought this was kind of odd," he said. "It bugged me that it didn't add up. I called Ross up to see what he had to say about it, and he sounds like a credible guy." Ross claimed the explanation was simple. Between the election and the inauguration, he had simply given away $2 billion to a trust owned by his heirs. Alexander at first assumed that the scandal was that Wilbur Ross was hiding money from the U.S. government. But after pressing the Department of Commerce to fill in the giant holes in Ross's story, he realized that Ross had misled Forbes for 13 years. "I went back in the files," said Alexander. "We at Forbes had initially counted the money that belonged to his investors in one of his funds as his own money. I was stunned that anyone had let that slide. He lucked into a way to be on the list without deserving to be on the list. But once he gets on the list, he lies for years." The Forbes reporters were accustomed to having rich people mislead them about the size of their wealth, but nearly all of them had been trying to keep their names off the list. In the history of the magazine, only three people stand out as having made huge efforts to get on or end up higher than they belong, said Alexander. One was Saudi Prince Al-Walid, the second was Donald Trump, and the third was Wilbur Ross. The scandal wasn't that Wilbur Ross was hiding $2 billion from the government, but that he'd never had the $2 billion in the first place. Alexander wrote up his findings, after which he said, "I got a bunch of calls from people who had worked with or for Wilbur Ross to say how happy they were the truth finally came out." The former number three man at Ross's old firm, who had worked with Ross for 25 years, spoke on the record. "Wilbur doesn't have an issue with bending the truth," he said. This was the man Trump had chosen to guard the integrity of the data on which our society rests. Yet inside the Department of Commerce, there came, in the spring of 2017, a ray of hope. In March, the Trump White House asked the help of Scott Rader, a science policy official at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. Rader had actually worked for the Department of Commerce and spent most of the George W. Bush presidency as NOAA's chief of staff. "They came into the Department of Commerce," said Rader, "and they discovered it's got this thing in it called NOAA, and it's 60% of the Commerce Department budget. And they said, 'What the fuck is NOAA?'" In the spring of 2017, Rader flew to Washington, D.C. to speak with Wilbur Ross about the place Ross was meant to have been running for the past several months. "It's not the Department of Commerce," Rader told him in so many words. "It's the Department of Science and Technology." It was a massive data-collecting enterprise, and the biggest collector of all was the Weather Service. NOAA also regulated the fishing industry and mapped the ocean floor and maintained the fleet of ships and planes used to gather information. It had collected all the climate and weather data going back to the recordings made at Monticello by Thomas Jefferson. Without that data and the Weather Service that made sense of it, no plane would fly, no bridge would be built, and no war would be fought, at least not well. The weather data was also the climate data. "If you don't believe in climate change, you at least want to understand the climate," said Rader. "And if you wanted to understand the climate, you needed to take special care of NOAA's data." There was no way Scott Rader could get across all he wanted to tell the new Commerce Secretary in a single meeting. "NOAA's a beast," he said. "It's 12,000 employees and they're decentralized, out in these tiny little offices all over the country. But it does more to protect Americans than any other agency, except for Homeland Security and the Department of Defense." Rader did get to tell Ross his main point about NOAA. "It's incredible value and everyone shits on it," he said. "The people are great. They aren't in it for the money. They're in it for the mission." And he asked Ross a question. "What's your philosophy for running the department?" "What do you mean?" asked Ross. "It's not really the Department of Commerce," said Rader. "Its mission is a science and technology mission." "Yeah, I don't think I want to be focusing on that," said Ross. "It was clear to me that he'd not thought about what the science and technology meant," said Rader. "He doesn't have a scientific bone in his body." But that was totally okay. The Secretary of Commerce could continue to pretend to be the Secretary of Business. But he badly needed to put people in place under him who understood the science. Rader assumed he'd been brought in for just this reason, to help the new administration find the right person to run NOAA. He knew qualified Republicans, inoffensive to Trump. He handed the Trump White House a list of half a dozen politically acceptable people who could do the job well enough. 6 months later, in October 2017, the White House announced its selection, Barry Myers. Barry Myers hadn't been anywhere near Scott Rader's list. He was the CEO of AccuWeather, one of the first for-profit weather companies. It had been founded by his meteorologist brother, Joel Myers, back in 1962. A third brother helped to run the company, which employed other family members, including Barry Myers' wife, Holly. The company was still privately owned by the Myers family, so it was hard to know exactly how big it was, or how much money it made, or how it made it. Staffers in the U.S. Senate, charged with vetting Myers' nomination, estimated that AccuWeather had roughly $100 million a year in revenues, and that these came mainly from selling ads on its website and selling weather forecasts to companies and governments willing to pay for them. Some weather geeks had recently discovered that the company had been selling the locations of people using its app, even when they had declined to give AccuWeather permission to do this. At any rate, at his U.S. Senate hearings, Barry Myers estimated his AccuWeather shares to be worth roughly $57 million. At first glance, the nomination made sense. A person deeply involved in weather forecasting was going to take over an agency that devoted most of its resources to understanding the weather. At second glance, both Barry Myers and AccuWeather were deeply inappropriate. For a start, Barry Myers wasn't a meteorologist or a scientist of any sort. He was a lawyer. "I was originally enrolled in meteorology as an undergraduate," he told the Wall Street Journal back in 2014. "I then dropped out of school because I was a horrible student." I was never interested in learning, which I now look on as sort of funny. Then there was AccuWeather. It had started out making its money by repackaging and selling National Weather Service information to gas companies and ski resorts. It claimed to be better than the National Weather Service at forecasting